those of you who have just joined, we're going to have Tony Gosling talking about propaganda.
My name is Tony Gosling. I was involved in... it's great to hear George Monbiot's name mentioned, although, of course, you know, nobody's perfect, George. But he was involved very much in something called The Land Is Ours, which I'm going to be talking about a bit later, which was came for me at a great time in 1995. I'd finished a couple of years before that at working as a journalist at the BBC, and to see something which was so positive, because there's one major thing I'm not detracting from anything that the fracking people are doing, for example, because what they're doing this weekend, last week, etc., is brilliant. It's so key to stopping our water supplies being destroyed and polluted. This is something that we've seen in the Middle East a lot. Over here, we're starting to see it too now. But George had a great idea, which was picking up on what's going on in the developing world in land rights campaigns, particularly the Movimento Sem Terra in Brazil, and saying, well, let's do that here in Britain. Because actually, Britain was the place where privatisation of land back in the enclosures in the 17th, 18th century, this is where this bad idea first started, the first and the worst, we call it, privatisation. So The Land Is Ours, George really started this first action at Wisley, but I'll be talking about that in a minute, because I'm here to talk about propaganda. As I said, I worked for the BBC for 3 years, which was a fascinating experience, being right in the belly of the beast at a place called Greater London Radio, where we had several million listeners a week. And when we were actually day-to-day working in a busy newsroom, was a lot of fun. When a story came around, we'd hear it maybe on another channel. We'd get someone phoning in about it. It'd come through on one of the teleprinters. This is the days before computers, folks. We had typewriters. This is 1990. It was a great fun as a kind of competition with the other stations and the other news outlets in London to be the first of the story. And, of course, as radio, if you find somebody who's actually at the scene of something, who's on the phone, you can just put them straight on the air and let everyone know about it. And actually, I'm really irritated by media now, as I'm sure so many of you are too, just feeling like either throwing something at the TV, turning off, because most of it is insulting. It's a kind of mixture of... inane nonsense and lies, most of it. Although, of course, there is some truth that's told. I mean, particularly last week, there was a particularly good Channel 4 News, which looked at Grenfell Tower and social housing, where they had some of the best people in the country on talking about that. But I switched on Channel 4 News the day after, and it wasn't on, because there was some sport competition, so no Channel 4 News on Channel 4. Anyway, so the mainstream press has got a lot of problems with it. But actually, there's a lot of people in there, like you and I, maybe, who are fighting to get the truth out. It's just that they're being slowly picked off by the people that own the transmitters, the people that own the printing presses. So, the war on terror, how about that for a lie? It's meant to be endless. That's the title of the talk. Of course, that is a quote from George Orwell in 1984, which does seem to be kind of happening, unfolding around us. Hang on a minute. You know, what is this all about, this war on abstract noun? And also, of course, how are you going to fight terror? Well, you just terrorise them even more with even bigger terror weapons and, of course, using the mainstream media to put people in fear. I think fear is used, I don't know what other people feel, but fear is used as a very clever way of actually getting to people's souls, you know, sort of undercutting their consciousness, getting to their subconscious. Getting people afraid of something is actually one of the most powerful ways of manipulating them. And I think many of us here at a place like this gathering are actually fairly wise to that. So we don't necessarily buy into these lies about the threats from North Korea, for example. I mean, just one example. Having had a look at this North Korean ballistic missile, we keep being told, oh, this is terrible, it can hit the United States. Well, actually, hang on a minute. The BBC themselves, if you look, will tell you that the missile, ballistic missile, inverted commas, that the North Koreans have been firing is actually designed to put satellites into space. It doesn't actually have any kind of system for targeting it on the ground. And also that the miniaturization of nuclear weapons is a very, very clever thing. The BBC themselves say, the experts say, that the North Koreans don't have the technology to do that, to miniaturize a nuclear weapon and even put it on this thing. So what we're getting is fear, 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 fear. Worry about North Korea. Well, I'm not saying North Korea's great. I'm no fan of Kim Jong-un, right? I wouldn't want to live there, thank you very much. But they're being used, they're being manipulated. And, of course, the way of getting at the Chinese by the back door is to get at North Korea, bad guys. Hang on, I'm getting fed up with these with these boogeymen. You know, Kim Jong-un is one of the latest ones. Of course, President Assad was the boogeyman that's still there, and he's apparently very reasonable, and we're starting to get to like him again now. But this is actually a horrific manipulation of our press. Another part of the title of the talk is the media and the corporations set the agenda. And this is, I think, a really important thing to understand, and I think they understood this many years ago, maybe even better than we do today, the way the media is used to lead opinion rather than to reflect opinion, to lead opinion. And it seems like the government doesn't react to anything unless there's something in the Daily Mail about it. So the idea is you get it into the mainstream press, the government reacts, it's an issue, and this it's called by Brian Eno propaganda. The idea is that you set the agenda by your propaganda. And of course, these mainstream, I mean, we've got a little radio station in Bristol, tiny radio station, and we're sort of just chirping away in a very small way. But the mainstream press have got the ability to get those big lies out to millions and millions and millions of people. And we've really got to understand that the people behind that are not necessarily the journalists. I mean, they may be the people we see on screen and on their bylines in the newspapers. Although, I don't know if you've seen, but there's €800 million has just gone to the Press Association from Google to help them to get artificial intelligence to write our news for the Press Association. So that means that stuff you're seeing in the newspapers and in TV and radio could be a Press Association release which has been written by a computer. I mean, this is an insane world we're going into where... You know, you haven't even got a human being involved in the process of telling us what's important and what isn't. So we've gone right the way from the media being there to reflect society, to enable people to control, at least discuss big issues like this. This is just from last week. One giant step for designer babies. The era of genetically modified babies moves closer as scientists prove they can safely alter human embryos. Safely. That's reassuring, isn't it? So we just forget about that because it's all safe. So that's what I'm saying about the actual agenda is being set by these people. And the, you know, as someone who's in the Journalists Union as well, we're very conscious that the people who own and control the media are the ones to watch, not the ones that that you see in the up front. I mean, so they are setting the agenda. They are actually manipulating the democratic process through saying what's important and what isn't, back to that Brian Eno propaganda idea. The other thing I think is some positive things about things we've been seeing are largely related to the whole Corbynista phenomenon, right? So we've seen for the first time in this general election campaign, first time I've seen it, maybe others have seen it too, is a senior politician, in this case Jeremy Corbyn, saying publicly the war on terror isn't working. It's taken 15 years for someone to actually have the gall to say that, who's in a position to do something about it. It's all very well someone saying that on Newsnight, which they don't, or anywhere else. But the thing is, Corbyn and the Labour Party are in a position to do something about it. So this is why, you know, it's all very well being a member of the Green Party, fine. You know, that salves your conscience. But if you're going to actually change anything, you need to be in a position to actually take power, which means taking over the control of the Treasury, effectively. Where is this taxpayers' money going to be spent? What are we going to spend it on? Are we going to spend it on HS2? No, of course not. This is a vanity project. Most of the people using HS2 will be on expense accounts. Yeah. So what are we going to do for ordinary people? The great thing about the debate on Channel 4 News this week was, or one of the good things about it, was that they started talking about social housing not being built. How... In the end of the 1970s, they stopped building social housing. So lots of houses are being built at about 150,000 a year, but they're all expensive houses, hardly any social housing. So that was what the government did after World War II. It's an important thing that governments do with our money from the Treasury is to build houses for us so that there's nobody sleeping in a tent, nobody in a shop doorway or whatever. And, of course, the housing issue is so important because you go down Maslow's hierarchy of needs, whatever it is. It starts with water, doesn't it? Then food. Housing, it comes pretty quickly down the list. So this is what I talk about, fear. The fear of being evicted, of losing your income, losing your job, is one of the most powerful weapons that can be used against us politically. And that, of course, one of the other things on that programme last week, I think it was Anna Minton, who's the author of Ground Control, pointed out we're now in a situation where government policy is, over the next couple of years, 300,000 children will be evicted because of the way that housing is organised, and also shipping people out of social housing, which they're starting to do in London, and also because of the cuts in benefits. We have a government policy that will evict 300,000 children. So just let that sink in a minute. What does that really mean? And do we want this as a people? Do the people that work vote Conservative because they think the Conservatives are going to preserve their pensions and make sure that their investments are protected and make sure they don't have to pay too much tax? Do they really consider the 300,000 kids that are being evicted as a consequence of those policies? But it's important, I think, to mention briefly the whole money agenda, because it's a much bigger much bigger agenda with money, in that we can quite easily print all the money we want if we want to. If we want to take away the power to create money from private banks, the private banking system, the Treasury can make up as much money as it wants, just like the banks have been doing, the Bank of England, with QE. And this is one of the things that John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor, and others around him, Richard Murphy, I think, is another one of these economist advisors, have been saying, we need people's QE. Look, let's just create this money. Let's get the Bank of England to do it. But let's spend it on ordinary folk and on infrastructure. Let's stop seeing our services being destroyed. With this thing last week, for example, with this poor mentally ill woman who's suicidal, has just been told, well, sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. Just go after walk the streets. We don't have any facilities to care for you. Of course, we could do that if we wanted to. And so it's quite exciting to see these ideas coming up through the Corbynista Labour Party, because they might actually happen. I did a bit of campaigning with the Landers House, as I mentioned, but our work at Bristol Community Radio is completely the opposite, I think, of what I'm now experiencing in the BBC. Things have changed a lot in the press. Very, very great deal. Since I was working in late 1980s and early 1990s for several years, and I could see a transition process going on just where I was working. So we're talking about something called producer choice they brought in, where every different cost centre in the BBC was told, oh, if you want to actually use any other part of the BBC, you're not allowed to just phone them up and ask them anymore. You have to fill in a form, and you have to get the permission of your producer or editor in order to do it. So actually, you know what? We never bothered. We just did it anyway, because we had all these people's phone numbers. And as I was ejected about 1994, so they were starting to get tough, you know. Well, you can't just phone up sport anymore and ask them something. You have to fit in the form. And they were starting to get tough on producer choice. Of course, it's nothing to do with choice. It's just about breaking up a massive, beautiful organisation as it was in those days into these cost centres that can then be gotten rid of. So they've done exactly the same sort of thing with the post office and Royal Mail, haven't they? You know, block it off into cost centres, regional cost centres, different types of parcels, whatever, and then they can start privatising those things as the private companies want to, because they're the profitable parts. More than that, though, we've seen a complete and utter destruction of any kind of moral sense of who's running the corporation, right? So they got rid of Alistair Milne, who was Seamus Milne, who's Jeremy Corbyn's press secretary, his father used to be director general of the BBC, and he was in the 1980s, so the period we've just been hearing about, actually before that, you know, the Battle of the Beanfield, the miners' strike, Wapping, all those big fights that were going on in Thatcher's Britain. So if you think about it, he was actually at the sharp edge of criticism of the Thatcher government. What he was doing was making sure the BBC did its job in criticising the government of the day. Now, do we see much of that now? Well, we see lots and lots of need for it, because of what the government is doing is pretty horrendous. But actually, they've completely changed the way the corporations govern. Now in charge of it, I'm not sure who the latest chairman of the BBC is, but it was Chris Patton for a while. It's now, I think, this woman, Rona Fairhead, as chairman. Now, she was the chair of the risk committee at HSBC. In fact, she was doing a job share as chairman of the BBC and also working for HSBC too. Now, who are HSBC? Okay, who are they? Well, they started as a Hong Kong Shanghai bank. We're involved in the opium trade. And then, now, more recently, they're still kind of interested in the drugs money because back in around about 2008 crash time, they decided, look, we're looking a bit shaky, so I tell you what, let's just do some deals with the Mexican drug cartels and because they've got loads of cash and we need cash. So they converted their banks over in Mexico to accept suitcases of cash. So you had a special kind of hatch in the side of the bank where the cash could come in and then be counted. It would probably take quite a long time to count this cash. But they did get the cash. They were fined a massive, great, several billion-dollar fine for that. So we've got someone who was the person who was deciding, now, here's a risk on our risk committee. Do we accept all these billions in cash from the Mexican drug cartels, even though we know it's money laundering, it breaks all the laws? Or what's the fine going to be if we do it? Oh, well, the fine's going to be tiny, so let's just do it. And so Rona, good old Rona at HSBC, is now the BBC chairman. So we're not really going to be seeing much panorama documentaries on HSBC. So the city's running the show. A friend of mine, Justin Walker, who was involved in the 9/11 truth campaign as well as I was, back in the, I suppose, late noughties, his uncle was a director of the Bank of England, and he was just coming up to his final meeting, and he was on the train with Justin going down to London. And he said to Justin, he said, look, here's a little bit of a tip for life, son. The Bank of England controls all of our political parties. So if a politician tells you they can do something, don't believe them, because they can't do it unless we say they can. And he also talked about the press as well, saying, actually, the bank controls the press too and pretty much owns and controls the press. So we will only be putting out ideas. And this is an important lesson for life for you. Carry that through to the rest of your life. So I think the money system, the money power, the control of the Treasury, the Bank of England is extremely important and much more powerful than we realise. So I'm not sure if they're quite into Brexit or not. We'll see. I mean, I think they're possibly not, but they are the people effectively who will decide. And of course, if they don't like it, they'll just throw money at trying to stop it. So the war at home. Okay, so the World War III, which seems to be sort of looming, and some would say it's been going on ever since the end of World War II. There is a home war as well, and that's to do with taking away our rights and our civil liberties. Now, the internet's been a big part of that. Certainly for me, for a lot of us, it's enabled people to just sort of connect up with similar-minded people around the world and also to look for what they want to look. It kind of encouraged us to be proactive in looking for what we want to find rather than just waiting for people to spoon-feed us with stuff. One of the things we're seeing a lot of now is the government talking about regulating the internet. Now, okay, so we've seen these three terrorist attacks in the run-up to the general election, which seems to have stopped now for some reason. I don't know whether it was connected with the general election or not, but it's all kind of not happening anymore, which is nice. But the question here is, when one of these people, I think it was the very first one, the guy at Westminster Bridge, immediately that attack happened, we heard calls for from the Prime Minister saying, "Oh, we've got to control the internet more because these people are being radicalised online. They're using the internet to communicate." Any terrorist worth half a penny is going to not use the internet. What they'll do is they will talk face to face. We've just had this guy Kieran Maxwell down in Taunton arrested from jail for 18 years for stealing a load of high explosives from the barracks at Taunton. Do you think he used the internet to talk to his mates to say, "Oh, I'm not sure how much high explosives I should steal. How many bullets should I steal from the barracks?" You know, of course they don't use the internet. This is just a way to get rid of our civil liberties. Of course it is. It should be obvious to anybody, but it doesn't seem to be obvious to the editors of Newsnight, to the editors of Radio 5 Live, and the rest of them. So it's just them that's doing this to us. It's not the terrorists, it's them. They will try and blame the terrorists. Mentioning Kieran Maxwell, isn't it funny how little press coverage that got compared to if this guy was in the Royal Marines and he was a Muslim? I think the whole world would have been talking about the Muslim that managed to get 400 rounds of ammunition, 14 pipe bombs, and various other military equipment in order to run a terror campaign. And yet we heard hardly anything about it. Actually, last night on the radio in Bristol, we had the new local MP, Darren Jones, and he said, look, I said, I'm a bit embarrassed to say this, but I hadn't even heard of this story. So many of us maybe will have heard about it, but because it was the main news for about half a day on most of the radio. But what we're getting is we're getting a whole load of spin about how dangerous these Muslims are. And what we're not being told, in fact, we're being withheld, the information is being withheld from us about how this Wahhabist fanaticism is being funded by Saudi Arabia, our great friends and allies in the Middle East. So it's all starting to sort of make sense, isn't it? That actually, they're much more interested in selling arms to Saudi Arabia than they are in actually keeping us safe. So that's how bad it is, folks. We've got these fanatical Islamic... Well, I don't even know if you can call them Islamic. Most Muslims would just say they're Wahhabists. They're not nothing to do with us, you know. But that is all funded by Saudi Arabia. Actually, after a deal which was done with the Yanks at the end of the World War II in Bitter Lake, and Adam Curtis is quite a good filmmaker. If you've not come across him, his Bitter Lake film is one of the best, I think. Commissioned by the BBC, but never shown on the BBC. Only available on iPlayer. But I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube or whatever. So if you've not seen that, it's a fascinating watch, as is his The Power of Nightmares, which is all about the use of fear in propaganda. So another thing I think is really important to mention to do with propaganda is this Grenfell Tower fire. Because of the timing with the general election, I think it's... I mean, some people are saying it's a conspiracy. I don't think it's in any way. I think it's just an accident that happens to have happened at a very interesting time. Worth remembering that the local MP there, the Labour MP, was only elected. She was the last MP in the country to have the count declared. And I think it was 40 votes she won by, beat the Tories in Kensington and Chelsea. And if you think about it, maybe those 40 voters came from Grenfell Tower, those 40 Labour voters that got her in and got the Tory out. So it does make you wonder whether some of this talk from the people on the ground down there about this, the locals are talking about it as not as a disaster. They use a different word, and that word is atrocity. This is an atrocity taking place in central London, or close to central London, because it was you couldn't quite say deliberate, but certainly it was an appalling lack of care for the people that lived there. It was deliberate lack of care, anyway, we can say that much, with a guy called Rock Fielding Mellon, who's the deputy leader of Kensington Chelsea Council, managing the whole project, and him being the one that was demanding cost-cutting through the whole scenario. And a horrendous atrocity. But I think, you know, I've just been picking these words up from the local campaigners on the ground. So how did it happen? Why did it happen? It's quite simple, really. It's the same reasons as were being brought up in the general election, to do with austerity and to do with the whole austerity agenda, taking, you know, public funds away, closing down the remit of local authorities. Local authorities don't have building inspectors anymore. For example, back in the day when they were building a lot of council housing, every one of these projects would have had a clerk of works. So who would have signed off that project, the refurbishment? Those clerks of works just don't exist anymore. And what they're doing is they're paying someone else to pay somebody else to do it. And you're just paying. It's a payoff to sign a piece of paper. And at the end of the day, is anyone going to be prosecuted? That's what they want to know. The people on the ground, is someone going to go to jail for this? Why hasn't anyone been arrested? Oh, it's not really a crime. Of course, they're hiding behind corporate law and corporations in the same way as so many of our corporations are, the people involved in fracking, etc. Another very, very good film is called The Company? Gosh, what's it called? A Canadian film. Can someone, the corporation, thank you very much. Absolutely brilliant film to watch. And it shows you the legal methods of hiding behind a corporation to carry out evil deeds. And that's what many, many of these corporations are for. They're just a front effectively, so that people who should be going to jail don't go to jail as a result. One of the things that we do on the radio is I was inspired years ago by a journalist called Duncan Campbell, watching his programs on the telly and reading his stuff in Time Out in London, and actually fantastic stuff he was doing and uncovering some of the dodgy stuff that GCHQ were getting up to. In fact, apparently GCHQ in the 80s wasn't allowed to be mentioned. This was so secret, this place in Cheltenham, you know, the donut now. Was so secret you couldn't even talk about it. But he did talk about it, and he said, well, look, this is basically, we're paying for this, so we should know what, at least a certain amount about what they're up to. What is the secret state up to? And so I've tried to carry on that tradition by really probing and looking into as much as I possibly can of interesting little investigations. I get a lot of people phoning me up at various times through the year, and every now and again someone will contact me and I think, God, this is definitely something in this. Two historical things which we've been digging into are to do with the traitors in Britain in the Second World War. So there were people, you know, quite clearly. I mean, Edward VIII was a Nazi. Mrs. Simpson was a Nazi. That's why he had to be abdicated out of the way, although there were lots of other, you know, reasons for it. But I mean, he was trying to cross into Nazi Germany. Imagine that. If Hitler had had the former British king on the radio broadcasting to Britain, telling us how wonderful Hitler was and whatever. But anyway, he was arrested by MI6 and sent over to Bermuda to get him out of the way. We had plenty of Nazis around. And during the war, this became a bit more serious, didn't it? And I started to look at this battle in 1944 of Arnhem, because I've been looking at the Bilderberg conferences for many years. These are very, very powerful groups of individuals that meet up in the from the NATO countries that meet up. Effectively, they are a close as you could get to a kind of secret government showing out. And secret government is very easy to do. Just look at P2 in Italy. You know, basically, you've got this P2 propaganda duo, Masonic Lodge, which was running Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, run by Lucio Gelli, a fascist. And they had the heads of all of the political parties. They had the heads of the newspapers. They had the chiefs of the secret services, chiefs of the police, meeting once a week in a nice big country mansion running the country. P2, just look it up if you've never come across it. It's a fascinating. That's how you run a country from behind the scenes. And you have the press basically in on the on the conspiracy. And Bilderberg is very much like this. So the press that go along are media owners. But I was curious about how and why Bilderberg started in 1954, 10 years after the end of the war. Having looked into that, the first chairman was a guy called Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. He was actually in the Nazi Party. He was a chairman for the first 20 years until the mid-70s. And he was one of the first members of the Nazi Party. He was a prince, and he married into the Dutch royal family. He was also an SS officer. So what is an SS officer running this conference for the first 20 years of all of the heads of many newspapers, big corporations right across Europe? Anyway, so I just felt there was something missing from about how and why it started. And I discovered through another contact that the Battle of Arnhem was very much involved, because Bernhard was involved in this. Now, has anyone ever seen the film A Bridge Too Far? Have anyone ever seen that film? Yeah, it's one, two, three. A few people. It's actually quite a good, as war films go, it's quite, you know, you think. It's a very important bit of history as well. And the idea was to take a bridge over the Rhine and actually end the war by Christmas. And I spoke to one of the veterans who was involved in it as well, who they were completely convinced, if we can hold this bridge, that will finish the war by Christmas time, 1944. And what happened was a whole bunch of tanks came up with Lord Carrington sitting in the first tank of the Grenadier Guards tank. And they just waited, because the Americans had taken the second to last bridge, but the tanks just didn't go anywhere. And everyone was like wondering. In fact, I spoke to an American soldier who was there at the time. He said, I pointed my Tommy gun to Lord Carrington's head, and I said, get down the blankety-blank road before I blow your blankety-blank head off. Right? So the Americans had taken this bridge. The British were just sitting around. They had a corps of tanks. So that's like probably 40, 50, 60 tanks. But they weren't going anywhere. The question was, why did they let the British die at the bridge at Arnhem? British people, British tanks, let the British paratroopers die there. And the answer seems to be pretty clear, that they didn't want the war to end quite that quickly. And there were traitors on the British side who didn't want that. Bernhard, of course, was involved. Now, you may not know, but he was a Dutch liaison officer. He'd married into the Dutch royal family. And he was involved in sending a spy in, a so-called spy, in to awaken the Dutch underground to the fact that this operation was going to take place. But it turned out that his spy was working for the Nazis, working for the Abwehr, which was the... So he went straight to the Abwehr and said, by the way, there's a big airborne invasion coming very soon. So the plan was given away by Bernhard. So Carrington and Bernhard were both involved in the treachery at Arnhem that led to tens of thousands of British and American soldiers being killed and captured. And so they were then... sort of, it was almost like an in-joke, because the Arnhem, the Bilderberg conferences 10 years later started, but they started in exactly the same spot as the British were massacred in Arnhem, at a place called Oosterbeek in a Bilderberg hotel. So you've got this little circle, which was called by the Germans the Witch's Cauldron, where they were massacring the British at Arnhem. I suppose, you know, knowing that they were going to win, basically. And that was the same exact spot where the Bilderberg conferences started. So... that was one big bit of treachery. The other big bit of treachery was to do with this guy, Martin Bormann. Now, hands up, anyone has ever heard of him? Yeah, quite a few, right. Well, he was actually running the Nazi Party after Stalingrad. Because for anyone that knows about World War II, Hitler basically kind of started to lose it after Stalingrad. I think most people knew they were going to lose the war after Stalingrad. And so Bormann started getting more and more power. A lot of people have questioned the flight of Rudolf Hess to Britain. Well, that was a Bormann operation, because he wanted to be in control of Hitler right the way up to the end of the war. Anyone else who was Hitler had a lot of time for, like Hess, or actually another guy, Reinhard Gehlen. I just can't remember all these names. But various people you'll find that Hitler said, I want this person to be my successor, they started dying off. So Bormann was the only one who was controlling him. Anyway, there's a fantastic book, Op JB, which explains that the Brits were involved in getting Bormann out, because Bormann had the keys to all the Swiss bank accounts and everything like that. Actually involved in getting him out, and then he made it over to South America. But there were lots of stories put out about Bormann having died, etc. So he was a key figure, but it was... people like Desmond Morton, Major Desmond Morton, who was Churchill's private secretary, and others, and Ian Fleming was involved in this as well, who actually the Brits were involved in all that. You know, I think the people, if they'd known at the time, or most of that generation that's still alive, would be absolutely gutted and really irritated to see that there were people who were prepared to sell everything out just for the money that the Nazis had looted from the whole of Europe. So that book, Op JB, is well worth a read, and I've tracked down some people involved in that. Now, a lot of people say to me, or quite a lot of people say to me, aren't you afraid of being bumped off? I mean, the stuff you do. Look, at the end of the day, I think you've just got to pursue the story wherever it goes. And as soon as you start getting into that sort of fear mode, then it's just not, you know, you can't actually have the integrity of what you're doing. I think there's plenty of people out there who understand this very well. As soon as you start making decisions based on fear, then... you know, you just can't really, you know, you kind of, it's a bit much more difficult to live with yourself. I've had death threats myself. I've had the most nastiest one was really from something called the Jewish Defense League, who are an outlawed group apparently in the US, who have, you know, quite a nasty track record. They're very close to the English Defense League. And so the whole, you know, I've been attacked quite a lot over the years for being, I mean, talking about verbally, part of the, you know, anti-Zionist cause, effectively, you know, by identifying the Israeli apartheid, which actually we interviewed Gilad Atzmon, who's a Jewish musician who's come to Britain last week. And he said, actually, no, it's not what apartheid is not what is going on in Israel. It's worse than that. They don't want to use the Palestinians. They just want them gone. They don't want them working for them. They just want them out of the way, and they'll use anything to do it. So it's whatever it is, it's beyond apartheid. So that whole side of things, you know, I think it's just important to say, you know, I'm not afraid of that stuff. I think you've just got to do it and do whatever happens. Now, how much time have I got here? Okay, brilliant. Right, perfect timing. Can we just have a couple of questions on anything I've just said, and then we'll go on to talk a bit more about positive things? Okay.
Can we just repeat that for the benefit of the recording and for everyone who can't hear very well?
I was just curious, Tony, why certain interests, either the Allies or presumably the Allies, would want the Second World War to continue.
Okay, good question. Right, because the Nazis had looted everything from Europe, every vault of every central bank, you know, everyone's personal art collections, wealth. I mean, at the time as well, they had these, and they still do have these things called bearer bonds, which are basically shares in a company, but whoever has the physical piece of paper has those shares. And the best book on all of this is called, is I've seen, is called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And what he does, Paul Manning was a CBS reporter in the war for, you know, reporting on the European war. And as he explained, that they needed time to get this wealth. Once the D-Day had happened, the Nazis needed time to get the wealth out, to squirrel it away around the world and move it all to Switzerland, etc. So they needed that extra time. If we'd have managed to finish the war by Christmas 1944, they would have not been organised enough. They actually only started the process of what they called Operation Fireland, Land of Fire, which was the idea that's actually to do with Tierra del Fuego in Argentina, to secrete their wealth around the world. They only started that process in August 1944, and it would have taken them longer to use all these various things like submarines, etc., to get the wealth out, and they wouldn't have been able to do it by Christmas. So they had to be given that extra bit of time.
Yeah, hi, Tony. A friend of mine lives in a similar tower in Portsmouth, similar to Grenfell, and they have similar cladding on the outside. And recently, since that happened, they decided, due to a suicide, that they were going to cage all the windows as well and give them one key, which lives at the bottom of the block, which terrified my friend, who's got a young son, and obviously everyone else in the block. And I said to them to go to the newspapers, but I don't know how that's going. Do you think it'd be worth him contacting maybe you or...
Look, who would you say? I'm always just get hold of me if you want to. Absolutely happy to do that. I would always say to people, though, do approach your local journalist first. You'll often find that they are absolutely up for this stuff. They may come up against an editorial block or whatever, but at least if the journalists know about it, a lot of journalists are pretty canny. Like, if their editor's trying to block something, that they might actually know someone else in another publication that can do something. So just take what I suppose is the most usual route. So go through the system. If the system can't help you, come to me. We had an amazing situation back with the 2012 London Olympics, where this guy who'd infiltrated the London Olympics came to Channel 4 News with this story. Look, you know, there's the G4S are hopeless. They're doing this. And he had it all documented. And Channel 4 News ignored him. So he came to us. He did a piece on the radio, which was supposed to be 15 minutes. It ended up being 40 minutes. And spilt the beans, effectively. Somebody, maybe him or maybe somebody else, then copied that onto YouTube. And it just went absolutely crazy. About a week afterwards, we were up to something like 300,000-400,000 views of that YouTube film, of that interview we did with him. And... then I was getting calls from everybody, BBC, who is this guy? Because we disguised his name, or we'd given him a false name. We want to speak to him. So I was just able to pass all those inquiries from the mainstream press onto him to decide whether he wanted to deal with it or not. You know, I don't want to talk to the Sun. Oh, yes, all right, I'll talk to the BBC or whatever. So, you know, there are ways of dealing with things. When your local press or when your national press even is trying to suppress something, come and have a chat with us, you know, and we can just stick you on the radio and off you go. It's a lot of radio. I always found it's one of the things that frustrates me is it's actually very easy. Get someone in front of a microphone like we're doing here and off you go. But it doesn't seem to be very easy. When I phone up, for example, the phone-ins, BBC phone-ins, never do they phone me back. When I was in New Zealand earlier in the year, I picked the phone up and I was talking to the whole country for about 15 minutes about everything, you know, all sorts of stuff. Over here, it's very controlled.
Hi, yeah, I was very interested in what you were saying about Arnhem, because my granddad was in fact one of the paratroopers that jumped out, and he was lucky to come back. He was shot through the neck, but he did get out. But actually I had a question about Bilderberg. Genuinely, this is something I don't know much about, but I was wondering what your thoughts are about the real influence of Bilderberg. I mean, they only meet once a year, as far as I know. Do they have a real influence on affairs?
Well, they have a massive influence. I mean, Will Hutton went, who was the editor of The Observer at the time, and he said that they set the backdrop against which worldwide policy is made. They're connected in with the IMF. They're connected in with all sorts of these big supranational institutions. I don't think the decisions are made at Bilderberg, right? This is a place where they're bringing in all sorts of potentially powerful people, in the leaders of opposition parties, like they did, for example, with John Smith just before he died, to see if these people are going to be on board the international program. And it is just the NATO countries, so it's not other... Also, you said, do they meet once a year? No, they don't. Because I've been sent information... The Italians are right onto this, and they understand secret government because they lived through it in a very open way with P2. And they've sent me various bits and pieces over the years to say, oh, well, there's a bunch of people meeting here. We've seen the booking is for the Bilderberg Steering Committee. So they have a steering committee that meets through the year. That's changed, by the way. The makeup of it's changed. Used to be, the whole thing started off with the Rockefeller family, and David Rockefeller particularly, who's just died recently. So that's bankers, effectively. You know, they started off on oil, but they realised just making money out of nowhere is a lot easier, you know, so they got into that. Now, the actual makeup of the steering committee is now, you look at some of the characters on there, it's much more to do with the internet and internet news and social media. So you've got Peter Thiel, who runs PayPal, he was one of the people that gave the money to start Facebook, and also Eric Schmidt from Google. So that's where Bilderberg is at. It's at controlling the future media. That is their obsession, really, I think. And one of the very first meetings in Germany, I met a guy at the Bilderberg conference last year who said that the guy at the very first ever Bilderberg conference, I think his name was, I can't remember the German guy's name, maybe Otto Jorn or one around about that time. But anyway, he was the founding editor of the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is a big paper in Germany. So they are absolutely obsessed with what is coming out through the press. Hence, so much of what we see now is propaganda.
And when you were talking about propaganda coming up to the election, one thing that was really bizarre, especially coming from someone who lives in Ireland, is the weird fixation that people kept insisting that Jeremy Corbyn was a terrorist sympathiser because he had met with members of the IRA during the 80s. But the thing I'm wondering is that, do you think it's more than just a case of access to information? Because it's very easy to find out how money is being funneled into the Saudis and all that. But do you think that there's a willful ignorance on people's part? Or do you think that there's fear that's making them...
Two questions. Let's do the first one, right? Okay. Look, a psychological operation against the public. That's what a general election campaign is, I think. And we're looking at terrorist attacks taking place. Of course, the first one, it was the second one, took place just literally 2 days after they'd had all this stuff about Corbyn as a terrorist, right? Suddenly, there's the Manchester explosion. And by the way, has anyone heard the woman who said, oh, there was someone sitting next to me, and she was fiddling with her bag, and she was really acting suspiciously, so we told the security, and she wasn't interested in the concert. She kept looking over to where the bomb was going to explode, yeah? So that interview with Sky has just gone... I mean, we've heard nothing more about it, but it was, I think it's quite possible that she was sitting next to the bomber. But the most important thing is they pointed it out to security. She doesn't seem interested. Security came over, but they didn't do anything. They didn't look in her bag or anything because she'd been fiddling with her bag. Even her daughter went over to security again and said, please, will you come and check that this woman isn't up to something? Yeah. And they did nothing. I would suggest you've got agents of one sort or another doing these bomb attacks, and then people being patsies or fall guys. Of course, what very often happens is they get killed by the police or by whoever at the time. So there's no trial, there's no possibility to interrogate. So this is a pretty sinister situation where you're getting major news events that aren't getting properly covered. So in other words, the woman who said there was someone next to me, it looked like she was acting suspiciously, no interest is taken in that, and then there's no court case afterwards in order to interrogate these facts. All you get is a bite of media on the day, and that you're supposed to accept that forevermore. Sorry, what was the second question, quickly, before I forget?
I was wondering, do you think, are people choosing to ignore facts because of fear, or do you think there's a certain level of willful ignorance?
Oh, look, I think the thing is, basically, people have got busy lives. They have to, in a way... trust what they're told. But I think we're getting to realise that we're being taken advantage of. People's better nature, people's trusting nature, is being taken advantage of. So you might see plenty of press coverage, which is perfectly reasonable, but then there'll be one key lie, whether it's to do with sarin gas in Syria, something like that. Oh, we're going to have to go to war with these people. We actually did, you've reminded me, thank you, we did a little thing on the radio last night. Where will World War III start? Because it's getting quite clear that this is hotting up all the time. We've now got a guy who's a military general from Iraq in the chief of staff of the White House. Now, hang on, he's a war criminal potentially. He should probably be standing trial for war crimes in an illegal war. But no, he's chief of staff at the White House, and he's from the Pentagon, he's from the Marines. So that is an absolutely horrendous, dangerous type of a situation there that we're getting into, with Trump is kind of almost on his own now. You know, he's a property developer, but he's surrounded by these hawks, by these military people. So we decided to look at, where will World War III start? Okay, let's look Eastern Europe, Ukraine, somewhere like that, or Syria or somewhere in the Middle East. And it's almost certainly going to be the US doing some kind of false flag attack, so making it look like the Russians have done something or Assad has done something, where actually it's them that's done it. And so kicking off some kind of confrontation between the US military and the Russian military, somewhere either in Eastern Europe, around that border. It seems to me this is just common sense, looking at what is going on in the world. Okay, so that starts to kick off. That could get nasty very quickly. And it could mean loads of American troops poured into Syria, for example, which is, of course, what they wanted all along. Essentially, this is for the Israelis' benefit, really, not for America's benefit or Britain or anyone else's. And then you would see China come in. I think after a war had been going on for a certain period of time, China would come in on the Russian side. A lot of people don't realise the Chinese are absolutely for and behind the East Jerusalem being a capital for a Palestinian state. That's what the Chinese have publicly said, and they've been campaigning for in the United Nations. So they're very much, you know, against the idea of the Israelis taking over Jerusalem and moving the capital to Jerusalem and knocking down the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which we nearly saw a few weeks ago again. Anyway, so I've only got 5 minutes. I must quickly run through some of the more positive stuff, because as part of the, I suppose, green movement generally in the 90s, we ran this thing called The Land Is Ours. Now, did anyone hear about that? That was a small bunch of us based with George Monbiot in Oxford. We occupied a place called Wisley, which is near the old St. George's Hill where the diggers were in 95. In 96, we occupied a piece of land in Wandsworth and put an eco-village there. Had a lot of fun, got a lot of publicity around land rights and the same issues which are going on in gentrification in Ladbroke Grove and Kensington, Chelsea now, because they were trying to build something like the fifth supermarket in the area. What we wanted was, you know, affordable housing. 1999, we did for the 350th anniversary of the diggers, we took over some land in St. George's Hill, which was even more fun. And the great thing about this is it's positive. As George said, this is campaigning for what we do want. There's loads of things we know we don't want, like fracking, but let's have a campaign, at least one, for the vision of the world we want to see. And so that's what got me so excited and into doing the Land Is Ours campaign. And of course, land is a free gift to mankind, and it's like every bit of it is being fenced off. In fact, there's that Leon Russellson song all about it. Then in 2002, we took over with Tony Wrench in Pembrokeshire a piece of an old Iron Age hill fort, which was open to the public, with these roundhouses. We took them over for the weekend to draw attention to the fact that Tony's home, a roundhouse, they wouldn't give him planning permission. And we got just ridiculous amounts of... We were the main news all weekend on radio, on BBC Wales, on the radio and the telly, etc. So you can make a difference, I think, and actually get a message, a positive message out, that think people are doing stuff about land. The purposes and the goals of that, and what we're doing is we're doing a sort of relaunch of the campaign. So I've just brought down some leaflets hot off the press, which are to do with making sure that there's a kind of focus across the country to come in behind local campaigns. We're not really talking about fracking. What we're talking about is people who, for example, have built a beautiful eco house and then they found that the local authority is trying to stop them. So the whole campaign has always been about, let's show a positive vision. So in other words, if some landowner's doing something bad, well, we may turn up on the scene, but we'll do something nice. We'll do something good. We'll plant some vegetables, whatever. Really in the same tradition as the diggers from the English Civil War. And I think without that, campaigning becomes a bit dull. You know, you can kind of get a little bit burnt out by constantly trying to fight against the system. Because the fact is, if you look at it from outer space, they're winning. Unfortunately, they're winning, we're losing. So let's do something. I think, you know, it's important, a good idea to do something which is actually what we want to see rather than trying to stop what they want to see. Thank you very much for listening. Before I finish, just websites. The Land is Ours is up there, tlio.org.uk. But also, I do the radio show. You can download that, take a podcast, listen anywhere you want, or listen live online. That's thisweek.org.uk. And the Bilderberg research is bilderberg.org. But I'll just let people know, if anyone wants to take one of these leaflets, come and have a chat with me afterwards, and you can see what we're up to and what we're planning. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tony. So if you want to chat to Tony, you're really welcome. The sun's shining. I'm going to ask you to chat outside because we've got Paul Mobbs coming in to talk about the clathrate gun and runaway climate change. If you've enjoyed this, if you thought it was interesting, if you find that what's going on interesting in the tent, please talk to other people. Not everyone knows that this is happening, and it's a really key part of what the Green Gathering is.